Good morning, everybody, and welcome to a Tuesday edition of Bio 231. And today is June 30th, Tuesday. Let's take a look at the schedule, see how we're doing. We're going to get into joints today in lecture. That's chapter 9. And we're not quite done with appendicular skeleton, but we'll be done really soon. That's chapter 8. All right, joints. What's another name for a joint? That's what we're going to be talking about today. What's another name? Fancy name. How about articulation? An articulation and a joint is the same thing, so I could have put that right here. And in this particular chapter, you're going to notice that it is not just pure memorization. You actually have to understand how some of these joints work and how they are classified, so you'll get a little taste of physiology in this particular chapter as well. Although I'd like to talk about physiology as much as possible, it's easy when we start talking about joints. And even for muscle, which we'll get into before the next test, which is on July 8th. And how far away is that? That's a week and one day away. All right, well, a week and one day, exam 2, chapters 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And we're going to get into chapter 9 today, so we still got to cover 10 and 11. 10 is just an introductory chapter to muscle tissue. What's muscle tissue specialized to do? To contract, right? To shorten. That's what muscle is. So we're going to look at that this week, even though it's a short week. It's a really short week because tomorrow's the last day, right? Because Thursday's a holiday. Please, probably you're all aware of that, but in case you forgot, Thursday's a holiday and we'll come back on Monday. All right, so that's the lecture schedule. Does anybody have a question over lecture schedule at all? No questions? We're good. All right. Let me turn some of these really bright lights down. I like them, but they're going down. Okay. All right. So we are good. We looked at appendicular skeleton last time. And who can just tell me in a nutshell, what is the appendicular skeleton? Appendicular skeleton, or you can start with skeleton and then tell me something about appendicular. It's bones, yeah, bones that make up your limbs. That's right, your upper limb and lower limb, and don't forget, it also includes some bones that attach these limbs to your axial skeleton. And there's a general term that we use to describe the bones that attach your appendicular skeleton to your axial skeleton. And what are those things? Okay. They have two specific names because they're two different ones, but generally they are called, and I think I heard it, they're called girdles, right? They're surrounding, like your upper thorax or your lower pelvic cavity. And so the upper girdle is what we call the pectoral girdle. Where's the pectoral girdle? Ah, here's a good picture of it. All right, so two bones that make the pectoral girdle are the clavicle and scapula. And today in lab, you get to look at these bones and model them on your body just the way they're supposed to fit. And especially this clavicle, because you can't really appreciate it by looking at these pictures in the textbook. And one thing, since we're here, we pretty much covered the upper appendage already. But one thing that I want to point out to you is that here is the humerus. You're familiar with the humerus. That is your bone in your arm. Let's see if I push the right button. Okay, I got my fingers crossed. I think it's going to turn on. All right, so we're talking about the pectoral girdle, and it's going to appear on the screen shortly. All right. Two bones that make up the pectoral girdle, clavicle and scapula. And I think it's waking up. Getting a little bit brighter. I think I can see some ribs there right now. All right. So here is that clavicle. Here's the scapula. And notice that the scapula does not articulate with any bones of the axial skeleton. Right? It's held in place by muscles. There are a lot of muscles in the back and of the thorax, front of the thorax, and also over the shoulder that it attached to the scapula, but it doesn't have a joint with the axial skeleton. What is the only joint that attaches everything in your upper arm to your axial skeleton? All right, so here's the humerus. Let's trace it on back. So here's the scapula, and there's no joint there. And then we go to the acromion process, and there's an articulation with the clavicle, the acromioclavicular joint. But remember, the clavicle is not part of the axial skeleton. You have to go all the way over here, right, to the clavicular manubrial joint. This is the only joint right here that's holding your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. Okay, not very much. So it's mostly muscles that stabilize the shoulder. Okay, so I find that pretty interesting. So we left off last time talking about the pelvic girdle. And who can tell me what bones make up the pelvic girdle? What bones make up the pelvic girdle? I have a cursor sort of on it right here. Yeah, I like pubis, that's one. Okay, ilium is one. And ischium. So there's three bones that have fused together to make an os coxae or coxal bone, right? So here's the ilium that's superior, and it courses posterior a little bit. The most anterior one is the pubis, and then the most inferior one is the ischium, and the ischium is the one that you're sitting on right now. All right, so this right here, I see two os coxae and a sacrum. Sometimes we call this a pelvis, right? And it is, the pelvis is part axial skeleton because the sacrum is axial skeleton, but these os coxae are part of the appendicular skeleton, but we call this a pelvis nonetheless. And there is such a thing as a male pelvis and a female pelvis. That's why we talk about it like that. All right. And we were looking at some specific structures on an os coxae. And here is a particular view. Remember, we said the ilium is superior, the pubis is anterior. So this is all the anterior side of an os coxae. Here's the posterior side. All right, but what side are we looking at? What's a good landmark? Are we looking medially or laterally? Okay. This, or maybe I should ask, is this a lateral view? All right, are we looking laterally toward the medial part of the body, or are we inside the body looking out? Okay, if we're inside the body looking out, I would call that a medial view. If we're looking from outside the body toward the inside, that is what we call a lateral view. So what would you call this one, and what's a good landmark to tell? Lateral view. And what's a landmark that just jumps out at you? The acetabulum, right? Just like the glenoid fossa on the scapula is lateral. The acetabulum is lateral on the os coxae. All right, so we got anterior, posterior, lateral, and superior, inferior. We know exactly how this bone fits. Be sure to take a disarticulated os coxae and put it on your body the way it's supposed to fit, and it'll be very obvious when you arrange it and place it on your body, model it on your body the way it should be. It will fit just perfectly, even though this looks kind of strange. All right, so we look at some of these features. I see that on the ilium, there are four major spines. And generally, what is a spine? A spine is a, what kind of anatomic feature is a spine? Is it a foramen, fossa, sulcus? What's a spine? A spine is a, it's a process. What's the function of a process? Yeah, muscle attachment, right? So here are some spines. There are two posterior, two anterior. There's one above the other, so there's a superior and an inferior anterior iliac spine, right? And the same thing for the posterior. There's a superior and inferior iliac spine, and the function of all these things is, you're going to just say, muscle attachment, right? And these muscles, most of these muscles go across the hip, so they're very strong, powerful muscles because they're holding your body up all day long. Okay. And so these are iliac spines because they are on the ilium. There's another important spine, but it's not on the ilium. It's on the ischium, which is down over here. And so we can't call that, right, an iliac spine. We would want to call that an ischial spine. And remember, there's only one. And it's easy to find because it's right between the greater and lesser sciatic notches. And that's a really nice landmark to look at, too. So if you can find that acetabulum in this greater sciatic notch, which everybody can, then you're going to be really familiar with this particular bone. And I'm sure I'm going to, if this is an exam figure, but I'll probably also make it a quiz coming up next week. I think on Monday of next week, we also have a lab quiz. Not a lecture quiz, but a lab quiz. Okay. So what else do I want to point out here? I think I talked about everything on this lateral view. Here's the medial view. And now we can see this fossa, right, which helps make up the pelvic cavity. And remember, fossa is in a bone to hold something. And so we have digestive, urinary, and reproductive organs that are held in this particular depression on the ilium. Right, so we call that the iliac fossa. If we look at the ilium, we see that it kind of flares open, right? It's narrow down here by the body, and it gets very wide up by the iliac crest. And the crest is a process as well, right? It's just a long, narrow process. What's the function of the iliac crest right here? What's the function of the iliac crest? You guys really know this. I got a feeling I'm working too hard. Okay? It's a process, so it is for muscle attachment. And very big, powerful muscles attached to it, and that's why this ostacoxae is such a big, thick, heavy bone, right? Because big, strong muscles attached to it. Pelvic organs, right, are held in the iliac fossa, and the ilium, you can kind of see, is narrowed down by the body and widens out by the time we get to the superior iliac spines, right? And if you look at this, it kind of reminds me of a fan or a wing. And a fan or a wing in anatomy is called ala, an ala, A-L-A. So that general structure that I see right here is an ala, but because there's a depression in part of the ala, we call this the iliac fossa, and if we go back to the previous slide, right, that same region, but laterally, it's labeled ala, right? But it's really what, this whole bone that kind of flares out like that. That's the ala. The medial side also contains the iliac fossa. Okay, arcuate line, that's an important line that helps define where the true pelvic cavity is, right? And the true pelvic cavity moves along the arcuate line, right? And then along the top of the superior ramus of the pubis, right? So here is the body of the pubis, so here's the superior ramus, and here's the inferior ramus. Remember, a ramus is a piece of a bone or a nerve or blood vessel that makes a 90-degree turn from the major part or body of something. So here's the body of the pubic bone. Okay, this right here, the auricular surface of the pubis, this is the most anterior in the pelvis. That's a joint. And there's fibrocartilage in here between the two pubic bones in a pelvis. And let's see what else. I think that's all I need to say about that ostacoxae by itself. All right, so what do we see over here? All right, I see a shaded area. In this region, I see the arcuate line. Once again, everything below the arcuate line is what we call the true pelvis. All right, but if we start at the iliac crest, right, and then move down to the rim of the pubic bone right here, all of this area is what we would call the false pelvis. So basically there are two. The smaller one is the true. The upper boundary is delineated by this arcuate line. The false pelvis is delineated superiorly by the iliac crest. Right, and they contain a little bit different organs. Okay, oh, this is a better picture, right? So here I can see the true pelvis, here I can see the false pelvis. And we'll point that out in lab for you. And we'll also talk about the difference between male and female pelvis in lab as well. All right, so we're done with pelvic girdle. And now we're going to get into the lower limb. Lower limb is, you could think of it just like what you've learned for the arm. There's a little bit of a difference, all right, because when you're in anatomic position, when you flex your forearm, when you bend your elbow, right, your hand and forearm move anteriorly, right? That's how that joint works, right? When you flex at the elbow, your hand moves anteriorly. But when you flex at the knee, which way does your foot move? Does it move anteriorly? Try it. No one tried it because I don't hear any cracking and breaking of bones, right? Your foot moves posterior. So there is some twisting around, a little bit of a difference. All right, so here is that pelvis. Here is a femur. Let's take a look at a femur first. Here's the head of the femur. It's a lot deeper, a lot bigger than the head of the humerus, and that's because this has to be a stronger joint because it's holding up a lot more weight. Your humeral or your scapula and the glenoid fossa is only holding the weight of an upper appendage, but this one here is holding the weight of your whole body minus your legs. And there is a little divot or dimple in the head of the femur, and that's called the fovea capitis. Right, capitis means head, fovea is kind of another name for a fossa, and that's an important attachment point for a ligament that holds the femur in place, and that ligament attaches on the other side into the depression that the head of the femur fits into, and you would call that thing, what do you call that depression that the head of the femur fits into? We were just talking about it. Really important landmark. It is the acetabulum, right? Acetabulum, and within that ligament there is a blood vessel that courses along with it, bringing blood to the head of the femur. And why is that really important? Somebody's got to tell me. Why is it important to deliver blood to the head of the femur right here? Tell me something about bone. Tell me anything about bone that you think you know. Okay. It's connective tissue, right? It's a tissue. Is it living tissue? Or just like this concrete pillar over here? Is it non-living tissue or living tissue? Living tissue. I like that. You weren't really forceful when you said that, but you should be. Oh, I thought they fixed that. Okay, but I'm glad the screen came back. So in order for it to be living, what does it have to have? Okay, but the definition of life. It does have to have blood because it's bringing in nutrients and oxygen and all that good kind of stuff. But in order for something to be alive, it's got to have a basic building block of life, and that's called a cell, right? And does bone have cells? What are they called? Osteocytes, right? Mature bone has osteocytes, so bone is a living tissue. It needs nutrient and oxygen that it gets from the blood. That blood is supplied via that ligament that goes through the fovea capitis. And when that ligament is damaged or that blood vessel is damaged, blood doesn't get to the head of the femur, and what happens to all those cells? They die. The cells aren't there to maintain the bone, and so the head of the femur degenerates, your body resorbs it, and so instead of a nice, smooth surface that fits into the acetabulum, you have a ragged, jagged end that's grinding the acetabulum away. And I suppose maybe you could kind of get a slight impression of how that would feel. How would that feel if this head of the femur dissolved away and you just have this jagged end of the neck of the femur rubbing up against the acetabulum? Okay, what could anybody think about how that might feel? Good? Bad? Everybody's shaking their head. Bad, we all agree it's bad. As a matter of fact, hurts like hell. Okay, so what would happen? What would somebody need then? How could we help a patient that has lost the head of the femur here? It would be called a hip replacement, right? Hip replacement, they've been doing these for years and years and years, I don't know how many decades. The surgical techniques are getting better and better and better. I don't think they're going to get you out of bed the very next day and do any running, but I would guess the day after that, you'll be walking. Okay, so, and maybe even, yeah, the day after, I'm sure they're going to get you up and do some exercising. All right, pretty successful surgery. And I want to tell you about a guy who is a professional baseball player. They're amazing athletes, but he was also a professional football player. And when I say football, I mean American football, right? Not soccer. He played both sports professionally, and he got tackled one time really hard up against the hip, and it damaged that blood vessel to the femur. What happened to his femur? Started to degenerate, right? Started just to dissolve away, so he needed a hip replacement. And he got a hip replacement, and he was such a phenomenal athlete that he couldn't go back and play professional football, or he made up his mind not to do that again. But he went back and played professional baseball. He was that amazing of an athlete, okay? And so I don't think any of us that actually become professional athletes, baseball players in the first place. But maybe if we could, it would be even more amazing if you could, right, play those sports with artificial joints, with a prosthetic hip right here. Anybody know who that athlete was? Yeah, that was Bo Jackson. I should have a website up here for Bo Jackson and show you. So yeah, Google him and learn something maybe about hip replacements, and just an amazing athlete, okay? All right, so if you ever need a joint replacement, just do exactly what the doctor tells you, right? And chances are you're going to come back pretty strong. All right, so here's that femur, and you can see that it sort of looks like a humerus, except it's more massive. The head of the femur is more massive than the head of the humerus. The neck is longer. There is no surgical neck because the anatomic neck is a place where the femur likes to fracture anyway. Right there, instead of tuberosities that we find on the humerus, we have trochanters. There's a greater one and a lesser one, just like on the humerus. Right, then we have the diaphysis or the shaft of the femur. There is a process running down the posterior part of the femur. We call that the linea aspera, and this linea just means line. All right, so here is like a crest running down the posterior part of the femur. And guess what do you think the linea aspera is for? It's a raised rough area. It's for muscle attachment. That's right. Okay, so we'll probably learn about some muscles that attach here, that attach to the greater trochanter, lesser trochanter. And that takes us to the knee. Okay, the knee is a lot simpler kind of joint compared to the elbow, because the elbow, right, starting in anatomic position, you can rotate the palms of your hands so that they're facing anteriorly or posteriorly very easily. You don't do that at the shoulder. You do that action at the elbow. You can't do that at the knee, right? Hopefully you, or I hope you never do that at your knee, because something's going to break. The joint isn't designed to do that. It's primarily a hinge joint that allows your leg, which is what, below your knee, to move posteriorly and then back anteriorly. We could just call that flexion and extension. We're going to look at what those motions are called, I think, in the next chapter. So it's a little bit simpler. There are two surfaces on this distal epiphysis that are very smooth. And in a normal individual, they're covered with hyaline cartilage. It helps make up the knee joint. And what do we call a raised smooth area on a bone that helps make up a joint? That's called a condyle, right? Like mandibular condyle. And this head right here, you could also imagine that or consider that a condyle, but it's got a specific name because it's on that part of the femur. All right, so there is a medial and lateral condyle, and there's medial lateral epicondyles. These are the epicondyles are processes, again, for muscle attachment. Right, but the actual condyles here are for what? Articulation, makes that articulation in the knee. And anteriorly, I can see it kind of fills right here, right in the middle of the bone. This is part of the condyle that articulates with the patella. And I got to go back a couple slides to show you the patella. But if we look on this really small illustration, I see a patella here and I see a patella right there, kind of a small bone. Patella is interesting because it's a sesamoid bone. And what's a common name for that little patella right there? Kneecap. Yeah, that's your kneecap. Sesamoid bone because it's completely surrounded by a tendon. It's embedded in a tendon. Right, that's what a sesamoid bone is. All right, between the condyles, we've got that intercondylar notch. You could call it a fossa. That would be fine. And I think that's all I would like to say about this femur. So, what part of the body is this femur in? Trick question. It is in your? It is, yeah, I heard thigh. I like thigh. It's in your thigh. It's not in your leg, is it? It's in your lower appendage, but it's not in your leg. So who knows? How many bones are in your leg? Let's go to the leg. There are two, just like there are two bones in the forearm, right? So your leg is between your knee and your ankle. So let's... I told you I was going to take a look at a patella. Here's a patella. All right, so it's almost triangular shaped. The anterior surface is a raised surface, and you can tell it's very rough because that's where a tendon from a big, powerful group of muscles in your anterior thigh attach to. Those are what we call the quadriceps, right? And then there's a ligament that goes from more the apical region of the patella down to a process that's on the tibia. It's called the tibial tuberosity, and we're going to see that right away, right? The posterior part of the patella is smooth. It's a condylar surface that matches up with what the medial and lateral condyles of the femur. Oh, I'm glad the femur is the next slide forward because I forgot to tell you something. All right, so here's a quiz. All right, I'm looking right here at this condyle, and I would like to know which condyle that is. There are two, right? So they have to have a name so you can distinguish them. You can talk about them because one could be diseased and not the other, right? So what condyle is this over here, and how are you going to figure that out? What condyle is this? Okay, your two choices are medial and lateral. And how do you know this is the lateral one? Because the head of the femur, can't ever miss the head of the femur, is what? Coursing medially, to made up with the acetabulum. So over here we have the medial condyle, and then over here the lateral condyle. Use the head of the femur to figure out which condyle that is. Okay. And that's really important because we're going to look at this joint in lab and in lecture. Knee joint is really important. It's easy to damage. And we got to know all about this knee in terms of anterior, posterior, what's happening in the center within this intercondylar notch, medial and lateral, because there's all kinds of special cartilages and ligaments that help the function of the knee. All right, so don't forget to know medial and lateral. Here are the two bones in the leg, right? Leg is between knee and ankle. And so you could almost think of these as the radius and ulna, right? But the names of these two bones are the tibia and fibula. And then there's something that you just have to memorize right away, just like you did for the forearm. In the forearm, which bone is lateral? Which one is lateral? Which bone is lateral? Or maybe that's how I start thinking, but let's go the other way. What bone is medial in the forearm? Go with anatomic position. What bone is going to be medial in your forearm? The ulna, right? That helps make up, right? The ulna's got that olecranon process that makes this point here on your elbow. That's the medial bone. And the ulna maybe is a little bit bigger of a bone compared to the radius. This, well, for sure at the elbow it is, right? So you got to know which bone is the medial bone in the leg. And your two choices are fibula or tibia. And look at that 100 times so that you don't even have to think about it. And it's not really obvious, so you're going to have to practice that one a lot, but you should be really fast with that. Okay? Because parts of the fibula and tibia make up a very prominent feature on your ankle, and both of these we call a malleolus. Right? On the tibia, we have the medial malleolus. On the fibula, we have the lateral malleolus. And so the tibia is the medial bone in the leg, and I can see it on this large illustration over here. All right, so the tibia is medial, the fibula is lateral, and you know what? As a matter of fact, you have the answer key attached to your body. You got two answer keys attached to your body right now because you can palpate your leg, right? You can reach down and touch your leg, and I feel a nice, really flat surface, and it's really hard. That's a bone. Right, and then I feel kind of a sharp ridge that's right next to it, okay, which is a little bit lateral. So you can actually palpate, right? You can palpate this surface right here. There's only some skin, there's only some integument over it. There aren't any muscles or tendons, so it's easy to palpate. Then you can find this sharp ridge. We call that the anterior border. Right, and so then laterally, if you try to palpate the fibula, there's so much muscle around it, you can't even feel it, right? So the bone that you can palpate is the tibia, and so you should be able to tell that's medial. All right, so medial malleolus. Here is an articular surface that articulates with some bones in the ankle. Got this anterior border. Here's a rough raised area on the tibia. We call that the tibial tuberosity. And that's what the patellar ligament attaches to. All right, so that's where that ligament from the patella attaches. And on the very top of the superior part of the tibia, there are some condylar surfaces, right? And these condylar surfaces, you have to know which one is medial and lateral. So if you pick up a tibia, how would you know that this one right here is the medial condyle? Because here is the medial malleolus. Right? That's a really good landmark. So that medial malleolus should jump right out at you, so you know that this is the medial condyle. Lateral condyle is over here. And in between the two, there is a prominence, call that the intercondylar eminence, that is poking up between the condyles, and it's a rough surface. So it's a process. We call it an eminence. And there's some very special ligaments that attach here that come down from the femur that stabilize the knee. And you've probably heard of those ligaments already. They're called the cruciate ligaments. All right, so you don't have to know that in this chapter, but we're going to get to that really soon. All right, so that's why that eminence is there, or that process. All right, on the fibula, which is lateral, here's the lateral malleolus. And here's the head of the fibula. And just like in the arm, here's that interosseous membrane. And so there's a joint, and this interosseous membrane doesn't stabilize this particular joint very much. It's not a very strong connection, but it helps stabilize the joint between the fibula and tibia to some degree. All right, so that's bones of the leg. Anybody have a question about those bones? Okay, just forget. Don't forget, medial malleolus is on the tibia. And then laterally, lateral malleolus is on the fibula. And I think it's easy to tell the anterior part of the tibia because of that crest, anterior crest that we see right here. It's a crest, but it can also be called the anterior border. Has anyone ever banged their leg on something? Their shin? Okay, and it hurts pretty bad. Because this anterior border is kind of long and narrow, and it's kind of a sharp point, and like I said, there's no muscle on top of it, so if you hit it on anything, then this bone is going to be contused right there, right? And it's just going to hurt because there's nothing really protecting it. Okay. Nice. All right, so down below the leg, we have the ankle and then the foot. And we had bones that make up your wrist. There are 8 of them. And does anybody know what the general name for all 8 of those bones is called? What are they called as a group? They're called, of the wrist, they're called carpals, right? They're called carpals. The bones that make up the hand are the metacarpals, and then the bones that make up the digits are phalanges, right? So we got carpals, metacarpals, phalanges in your hand. In your foot, right, they're not carpals that make up the ankle, they are tarsals. Tarsals, the general name. There are 8 of them. I want you to know in this particular case, 2 of them, right, in the wrist, only 1 I wanted you to know in particular. And then here are the metatarsals, right? Use your understanding of the hand to name these things. And then here are the phalanges. And we named the metatarsals just by number, starting with the great toe is number 1. What's number 1 digit on your hand? Is your thumb, yeah. Okay. Well, let's take a look at the tarsals, the 2 that I want you to know. Here is the most massive one. It is very strong, and this is the calcaneus. This makes up the part of your heel. This is the bone that strikes the ground when you're walking, and even maybe when you're running, unless you run with other kinds of techniques. This is the part of the bone of your ankle that holds up your whole body weight, right, that you just pound into the ground. Right above that is the talus. So those are the 2 that I want you to know. The talus is really important because this is the bone that articulates with the tibia and fibula. And this part of the talus, right, we call this the dome of the talus, fits right between the medial and lateral malleolus. It just fits right in that notch. Let me go back. All right, perfect. Let's look at this plain film right here. All right, so here, what would you say? Let's pretend that this bone isn't fractured. I see a couple fractures right here. But let's name this bone. What bone do I have the cursor hovering on right now? That's the tibia. And over here is the fibula, right? And then here would be somebody's ankle bone sticking out medially. And this is what we call the medial malleolus. Over here is the lateral malleolus. And you can palpate those little things right now on your ankle sticking out. And it forms a nice notch. Right, the fibula and tibia make this notch right here, and that's what the dome of the talus fits into really nicely. Right, so that's why those malleoli are there. And so those are the 2 bones, calcaneus that I can kind of see here, and the talus I can see a little bit above it, right? Calcaneus and talus. The rest of these are just what we call tarsals, right? Metatarsals are named just like the metacarpals in the hand, and then the phalanges have the same arrangement. Digits 2 through 5 have 3, right, phalanges, the proximal, middle, and distal, but on the great toe, there are only 2 phalanges, a proximal and distal, just like in the thumb. Okay, so that's it for appendicular skeleton. Some other things I'll talk about in lab, but that's it for appendicular skeleton for lecture. Any questions? Any interesting comments? Observations? Want to share an experience with us with your appendicular skeleton? Do you have any novel parts of an appendicular skeleton? You all have all your joints still? Any artificial joints? Prosthetic joints? Prosthetic bones? You all got kneecaps? Yeah, well, we're all pretty boring, which is okay. All right, so let's move on to joints. What's another name for a joint? Articulation. Yeah, articulation. All right, so I get to put some of this stuff away and maybe shut that chapter. Ah, good. I didn't shut that chapter down yet. Okay, articulations. And the word slide that I want is right here. Okay. So these notes that I made for you in the lecture notes are pretty important. So read the chapter, look over these notes, read the chapter again, read over these notes, and it will make a little bit of sense. Okay, so a joint is what? Just a bone-to-bone connection. And there are many different kinds. And we want to classify joints by a couple different criteria. One characterization we can classify a joint by is the structure. Right? The structure of a particular joint is what? Just how it's built. What does it look like? How many pieces are there to it? Right? That's a structural classification. And so it's based on the shape, but also by the stuff that holds the bones together. Helps make the structural classification. So there are 3 subcategories: fibrous, cartilaginous, and synovial. Synovial is a really special kind. We're going to talk about that last. Right? A fibrous joint just has collagen fibers that attach the bones together. Right? And sometimes that can be a really tight connection, or it could be a little bit of a loose connection. Right? Cartilaginous is another kind of joint by structure. And guess what's in the joint? Cartilage. Yeah, there's cartilage that holds things together. All right? A synovial joint that right here, right, has a number of different components, and it's a special case, so we're going to look at a synovial joint by itself in a little bit. It's got cartilage, it's got fibers, it's got fluid, it's got all kinds of stuff. So it's a really nice and different kind of joint, probably one of your favorite when we take a look at it. All right, so that's by structure. And if there are different joints by structure, that means that there are joints that have different functions, right? So we can also classify joints by their particular function, right? And we can start with immovable joints. Immovable joints are joints where bones are held together where there's almost no motion. So as a matter of fact, you could say no motion, but there's always going to be maybe some slight motion that's almost imperceptible. So we're going to call that an immovable joint. An example would be a suture. Right, so these joints between bones of the cranium hold your cranium together, but the cranial bones do move, right, when we breathe, when your heart beats a little bit, but very subtly. Right, you have to have really special training to appreciate that motion. All right, so joints that are immovable are called synarthroses. Okay, and arthroses right here just stands for joint, right, like articulation. That's where this comes from. A joint that is a little bit more movable than a synarthrosis is called an amphiarthrosis. And then there are some joints that are freely movable. And remember in the skull, I said there's only one freely movable joint. Anybody remember what joint that is in the skull? I'm exercising mine a lot this morning. It is your TMJ. Your TMJ is a freely movable joint. right? And that's what we call a diarthrosis. And the example that we see here on the slide is an elbow. Okay, so how are you going to remember synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, and diarthrosis? Well, if you take the first letter of each of these words, it spells another word that actually makes sense, which is sad. Right? So sad is immovable. I mean, S in sad is immovable. The D in sad is the freely movable joint. You just got to remember synarthrosis, amphi, and diarthrosis to make sure that sad makes sense to you. Okay. All right, so let's look at joints, and in particular, fibrous joints. And what how would you classify a fibrous joint? Is that by function or by structure, a fibrous joint? Fibers are a structure. All right, so this is part of a structural classification. And there are some different kinds of fibrous joints, right, and they have their names. Suture is one that you're familiar with. You don't have to learn or memorize anything new with that. All right. But here are two more. A syndesmosis is a joint that's held together with a ligament, right? Like the distal fibular joint right here. I can see a ligament that attaches right here. It's a longer joint, right? The suture is a very narrow kind of joint. And the length of this, of a syndesmosis, is variable in the body. And it's a pretty strong joint. Okay, pretty strong joint. Another ligament between two bones, right, is what we call a gomphosis. And then here is a tooth. And let's just say that this is the mandible. What do you call this depression in the mandible that the root of this tooth fits into? You all know what that's called. That is called, you've been tested on it already, but not maybe in lecture. That's an alveolus, right? The socket that the root of the tooth fits into, that's an alveolus. And so this is what we call a gomphosis. Gomphosis is a peg and socket kind of joint, and I can see a bunch of ligaments that is holding this tooth into place. Those are what we call periodontal ligaments, right? Those which are pretty strong, and when you lose your baby teeth, this ligament degenerates so that that first bunch of teeth can actually be removed from the alveolus. This joint right here does have some pain receptors within these ligaments, and maybe you bit into something that you thought was soft and there's actually something hard in there, and it tweaks this tooth a little bit, stretches these ligaments, right, and it feels really uncomfortable, right? Like you bite into maybe a hot dog and there's a piece of bone in it or something, right? It can deform these ligaments. All right, so those are some fibrous joints by structural classification. Let's look at some cartilaginous joints. And, right, cartilaginous joints, we're going to find cartilage of different kinds. And you know there's different kinds of cartilage. And let's look at some subclassifications. A synchondrosis. Right, how would you know that this is a cartilaginous joint if somebody were to say synchondrosis? Yeah, because chondro is cartilage. That's nothing new that you have to learn right there. And a synchondrosis is a joint that the bones are brought together with hyaline cartilage. Right, so that's the weakest kind, doesn't have a lot of fiber. As a matter of fact, it's lacking fibers. And some synchondroses are immovable. Like here's one I see between the proximal epiphysis on this humerus and the diaphysis. Here is a plate, right? We call this the epiphyseal plate or growth plate, and it's hyaline cartilage. So what can you tell me about this joint? Is it weak or strong? If it just has hyaline cartilage, it's relatively weak. It's a relatively weak joint. It's very important because this is what we call the growth plate, remember? This is how a bone grows in length, both at the proximal and distal epiphysis. Can be damaged very easily by twisting or compression, and then the bone stops growing in length, which is terrible if you're just a young person, haven't grown very much. Okay. So what do we call an immovable joint, again? By function, an immovable joint. And this one right here, the epiphyseal plate, is an immovable joint. It shouldn't move. If it does, it gets damaged, which is, you'd have to use that acronym SAD, And the immovable joint is which letter in SAD? The S. And what does S stand for? What does S stand for? Syndesmosis? Okay, no. It's called synarthrosis. Synarthrosis is the immovable joint. Okay, there is another one, just for your own information. This first cartilage between the first rib and the manubrium, okay, that is also a synchondrosis. Okay, a couple examples. The other kind of cartilaginous joint doesn't have hyaline cartilage. It has fibrous cartilage. So how strong is that compared to hyaline cartilage? A lot stronger, right? And here's a really good example, the fibrocartilage. All right, between the vertebral bodies, can you imagine? I can almost see it. Here's a body of a vertebrae, right, transverse process over here. Here's that superior articulating process. Here's the inferior one, which articulates with the superior one on the vertebrae below it. And in between the bodies, right, because the bodies of vertebrae are just bones, we don't want these bones to rub together because that would grind them away, and in some circumstances that can happen. So there's some special cartilage in between them called the intervertebral disc. And so here's that intervertebral disc. It is fibrous cartilage, and in particular we call this a symphysis, right, a symphysis. So in this case there's slight movement between the vertebral bodies because you can rotate your vertebral column a little bit but not too much, right? You can flex and extend your vertebral column, but not very much. So this is a slightly movable joint. All right, so what do we call a slightly movable joint? In SAD, it is the A. A stands for amphiarthrosis. Okay. The other kind of symphysis joint is the pubic symphysis. We mentioned that between the two pubic bones. That's a very strong joint most of the time. But in women during parturition, this joint dissolves away, right? And just like this iliosacral joint over here, it gets weaker, and that allows the pelvic bones to separate from each other a little bit. That enlarges the pelvic outlet, which is the foramen that's formed as you look up into the pelvic cavity from below the pelvis. And of course, that aids parturition and allows the fetus or the newborn baby to be delivered. And then after parturition, the hip bones come back together, pubic symphysis reforms, and the pubic bones come back together mostly, but probably not exactly where they were before. Okay, that can happen to guys as well. All right, they can have separation at the pubic symphysis here, and typically how that happens when you go through the handlebars of your motorcycle. Okay, and that's terrible when that happens. Probably the pubic bones don't come back together quite so nice after that, not as in women. Okay, so that's a symphysis. Synovial joint. Synovial joint is by a structural classification again. We said that was pretty special. We got to know some pieces of a synovial joint. One nice thing about synovial joints for memorization purposes, all of them are diarthroses. So in terms of function, what is a synovial joint? In terms of function, what is a synovial joint? In terms of function, you got immovable, slightly movable, freely movable. And the diarthrosis is freely movable kind, right? So probably most of your favorite joints are diarthroses, like your shoulder, your elbow, right? Between your phalanges, your knee, your hip, and your toes. Those are all diarthroses, freely movable joints. And all diarthroses have some common features, and there's a special feature in some of them that we'll talk about in just a little bit. So what are the common features that every synovial joint has that allows them to be freely movable? And I see it on this slide right here. Maybe I'll go to the next one. Do I have it? Yeah, this is good. Okay, so here is an important exam figure. Very easy to label once you analyze it and dissect it. All right, so here is the remnants of that epiphyseal plate that just looks like an epiphyseal line. I see some nice spongy bone, cortical bone. Then on top of the cortical bone, on the superior bone, I see some hyaline cartilage. All right, so hyaline cartilage, very important piece of a synovial joint, covers the proximal epiphysis, and then on the distal bone, there is some additional hyaline cartilage. Hyaline cartilage is not very strong, but it is what? Smooth and slippery. So it's a perfect kind of tissue to help make up a joint between bones that are moving. And it prevents these bones from grinding each other away. I can see a nice epiphyseal line right here once again. Okay, and that hyaline cartilage doesn't have much vascularity, right? There isn't a lot of blood supply, but there are cells in there. So what can you tell me about hyaline cartilage if it has cells? It's alive, yeah, it's a living tissue, right? So it gets nutrients from a fluid that is swooshing around on top of it all the time, and that's what we call synovial fluid. Synovial fluid can help maintain the health of this hyaline cartilage, but if hyaline cartilage gets damaged, there really isn't enough oxygen and nutrients or cells to rebuild that cartilage. So once cartilage is damaged in a joint, it does not grow back, unfortunately. Okay. There can be scar tissue that forms that might help protect the ends of the bones, but there's no hyaline cartilage. So if we change the structure of a joint by removing the hyaline cartilage, what else is changing? Yeah, you will miss that joint, the one that you had, right? Because it just won't function the same way. Okay, so where does that synovial fluid come from? It comes from a synovial membrane. And here I can see the synovial membrane. Right, that which is more exterior in the joint, and it secretes synovial fluid. It just kind of weeps into this synovial cavity, right? So the synovial cavity is the place where the synovial fluid exists, and a fluid comes from the synovial membrane. Synovial membrane does not have a lot of collagen, so what can you tell me about the synovial membrane if it doesn't have a lot of collagen? Is it strong or relatively weak? Is relatively weak, right? Its job is to make synovial fluid, but not to stabilize the joint, right? That helps maintain the hyaline cartilage because it secretes synovial fluid. But fortunately, there is a stronger connective tissue layer that's superficial to the synovial membrane, and we call that the fibrous capsule. Fibrous capsule is right here, and what kind of fibers do you think are in the fibrous capsule? You know there's fibers in there because the name tells you. What kind of fibers do you think that's in there? Collagen fibers, right? Collagen fibers. And which means that, right, it doesn't stretch very much in the longitudinal direction, but if you stretch it sideways, it can rip pretty easily, right? So collagen is good pulling from end to end, but if you pull it from side to side, it can separate the fibers out. So if we put the synovial membrane with the fibrous capsule together, then we get something called the articular capsule. And then what's another name for articulation? Yeah, joint. Okay. So the fibrous capsule, synovial membrane put together, you could probably call that a joint capsule as well. Okay. All right. So what else do we have? Synovial fluid. Ah, now here's something that really helps stabilize the joint, and it's a ligament. And what kind of connection? What does a ligament join? What are the two structures that a ligament joins together? Bone to bone connection is a ligament. A bone to muscle connection, which is not shown on the slide, is called a tendon. Exactly the same kind of tissue, which is what? Dense, regular connective tissue. All right, so here is a ligament that spans the joint, that stabilizes the joint because it's very strong tissue. So that ligament then incorporates itself into the periosteum, right, which is the membrane that surrounds the bone. The periosteum incorporates itself into the cortical bone, right, via those Sharpey's fibers. So all these things kind of get locked together. So this is a very typical kind of synovial joint, and a synovial joint by function is which kind? By function, which kind is a synovial joint? So what are the kinds of function? Immovable, slightly, freely movable. And a synovial joint is 100% of the time freely movable. Freely movable, which is what? Diarthrosis, yeah. Okay. I almost forgot. Thanks for reminding me. Okay, so what else can we find in joints? I have a slide over here. Let's look at the word slide. Reinforcing ligaments we looked at, there can be nerves and blood vessels, damage a joint, it will hurt, it can hemorrhage, right? And here are two things that we haven't talked about yet, bursa and tendon sheath. So let's go back and remember what a synovial joint looks like. What does a synovial joint look like? Well, it's got a synovial membrane, right? And it's got a fibrous capsule, and there is fluid on the inside. So this is kind of a slippery structure right here. And if we take the bones away, it kind of reminds me maybe of a pillow, right? And the interior stuff right here is pretty squishy and soft and smooth. Well, a bursa is sort of the same kind of thing, right? It is within or very close to a synovial joint, but it doesn't surround a bone. A bone is just like a synovial joint without the bones, and I see one right here between the acromion and the head of the humerus. And so I see a synovial membrane, I see a fibrous capsule, I see synovial fluid on the inside. So this is a nice shock absorber. And this thing can actually roll around. When you move your shoulder, okay, this thing is going to protect the head of the humerus from this big bony prominence right here, right, the acromion on the scapula. So this is a bursa. A bursa is found between a bone and a muscle that might pound up against it. You might find a bursa between a bone and a ligament that might pound up against it. Right, and so it just prevents inflammation, and it produces a nice smooth fluid motion between those muscles, ligaments, and bones, but it's basically there to protect those soft tissues when they bang up against the bone. All right, so remember, you can have an inflammation of the pericardium called pericarditis. You can have inflammation of a pleural cavity called pleurisy. And you can have inflammation of the peritoneal cavity, like when your appendix bursts open. Anybody remember what that inflammation of the peritoneal cavity is called? Like when your appendix bursts open, it's called a peritonitis, right? You can also have an inflammation of a bursa, and that is called bursitis, right? And bursitis, right? This bursa right here gets inflamed, it gets enlarged, doesn't quite fit in this little space anymore. When it moves, it's painful. So bursitis can be a very painful kind of condition. And probably the best treatment for that is rest, or maybe steroids if that doesn't work. Okay. And just think of this bursa as a synovial joint without the bones. There is another kind of thing that reminds me of a synovial joint without the bones, and we call it a tendon sheath. It is very much like a bursa. Right, there's a synovial membrane, fibrous capsule, but in the case of a tendon sheath, it kind of wraps itself around a tendon. And a tendon is what? A muscle-to-bone connection. And so when this muscle contracts on this tendon, this is a tendon from the biceps brachii. Probably everybody knows where your biceps is. When your biceps contracts, puts a lot of tension, and this tendon will slam up against the head of the humerus, and it's the job of this tendon sheath right here to maintain mobility and reduce friction, right? And so that reduces inflammation. It keeps this joint nice and healthy. This tendon goes all the way over the head of the humerus and attaches to the rim of the glenoid fossa. Can you see the glenoid fossa right here? It's not very deep, right? All right, so this is a very long tendon, and the tendon is protected, the humerus is protected by a tendon sheath, which is a lot like this bursa. All right. On this particular view, I see something pretty important. I see some soft tissue, and this is not an exam figure, but maybe you've heard of some of this soft tissue, but it also points out something important. What can you tell me about the depth of the glenoid fossa? Is it deep or kind of shallow? Is it a deep depression or is it a shallow depression? Especially if you think of the acetabulum at the same time. Shallow or deep? Yeah, it is shallow, right? So that's okay because you have a lot of freely range of motion with the shoulder. It's just not as strong as your hip because the depth of the glenoid fossa is pretty shallow. There's something that enhances the depth a little bit. And can you see this little nibbin here and this little nibbin right here? It's actually a ring that completely surrounds and circles the glenoid fossa, and it makes the fossa a little bit deeper. But this is not bone, right? So it's still not as strong. This is still fibrocartilage. And This is, oh, I forgot, but then I remembered, thank goodness. This is what we call the glenoid labrum. Glenoid labrum, because there's the glenoid fossa, and if you're a sports enthusiast, we know that the glenoid labrum, since it is cartilage, can be damaged pretty easily. And if you're like a major league baseball player and you damage the glenoid labrum, unfortunately, your career is over when that happens. All right? Because cartilage is not as strong, it's basically avascular, so it does not regenerate, it does not heal itself. But it helps stabilize the shoulder as long as you don't overdo it. Okay, can you see that little glenoid labrum right there? All right, so tendon sheath, bursa, glenoid labrum, important points of a synovial joint. The labrum particular to the shoulder joint. Sometimes we call that the glenohumeral joint because that's a glenoid cavity, and here's the humerus. Some joints have another piece of cartilage. Another piece of cartilage. Let's go find another piece of cartilage. Let's find a knee or maybe a TMJ. A knee or TMJ. A couple synovial joints have another feature besides a bursa, besides ligaments. Okay. Ah, here's a knee. This is good. Where's a knee? Okay, I'll start with this slide. Here's a knee, right? So here is the tibia. Here is a good test. What side of the leg is the tibia on? Medial or lateral? Yeah, medial. Really good. You just got to yell that out somehow, be familiar with it. Here is that tibial tuberosity. Laterally is the fibula. Here are those muscles that I talked about that insert into the patella. There's four of them, so we call those the quadriceps. That's pretty easy to remember. Here's the tendon of the quadriceps going into the base of the patella. From the apex of the patella, here is the patellar ligament, because a ligament is what? A bone-to-bone connection. All right, so the tibia is medial. The knee has another special cartilage, because there's a lot of pressure that is imposed upon the knee. All right, so let's look into the knee. We've taken the muscles away. We've bent the knee. We've taken the patella out of the way. We've reflected that down so we can look into the knee, and I can see the condyles of the tibia, the condyles of the femur, and here is a condyle of a femur. What condyle is this? What condyle is this? Your choices are medial or lateral? Medial. Here's a medial condyle, here's a lateral condyle, right, because the tibia is medial, right, in your leg. So here are a couple cartilages. They kind of look like the letter C. So we say they're C-shaped cartilages. They are fibrocartilage. So in terms of cartilage, are they weak or relatively strong? Yeah, they're relatively strong. That's a good thing. And they're called a meniscus. And so since the tibia is medial, we're going to call this the medial meniscus. And then one way out over here, closer to the fibula, that is the lateral meniscus. And since they're cartilage, they can be damaged, they can be torn. And when they're torn, or where they're most easily damaged, is their thinnest part. So if you look at a meniscus right here, can you see where the part is the thinnest? Is it on the exterior or is it more on the interior? A meniscus, I said, is shaped like a C, but it's also kind of shaped like a wedge. It's very thick on the edge, right, and it gets relatively thin as it moves to the interior of the knee, and it's this edge right here that has a tendency to break off, or the tips of the C have a tendency to break off as well. Right, and then you have a lot of pain, but if it breaks off completely, then you have this like wedge-shaped piece of cartilage in your knee, and it can wedge in different places, and it can lock your knee up to where you don't have motion. Right? Okay. Well, when somebody damages their meniscus, you need a good consultation. Maybe that cartilage that's broken needs to be removed, or if there's just a tear, maybe part of the cartilage on the other side of the tear has to be removed. Early on to deal with a torn or damaged meniscus, they would just remove the whole meniscus. That would solve the problem, right? You don't have that piece floating around in there. But can you imagine what the consequence might be if somebody removes this whole meniscus in somebody's knee? It's there for a reason. What is this meniscus doing? It is protecting the ends of these two bones. If you remove it, then the hyaline cartilage is going to rub up against each other, and that will cause an early degeneration of the knee when that happens. So now when a meniscus is dealt with surgically, the smallest piece of meniscus is removed and as much meniscus is preserved, right? And so you're trying to change the structure of the knee the very least, right? Not a major change. And if you hardly change the structure of the knee, what can you tell me about the function then? The function hardly changes, right? So knee meniscus sparing surgery is a more advanced technique and it's highly recommended. All right, so that's the third, that's another kind of thing that some synovial joints have, and that is, right, within the joint capsule is a meniscus, which is fibrocartilage. Another joint that has a meniscus is the TMJ. Who knows where the TMJ is? Point to where your TMJ is. Don't have to say anything. Yeah, you got it right there. Okay. Okay, so that is meniscus. Where do I have meniscus in here? Ah, here. Okay. Okay, so synovial joints are freely movable, right? And so what determines the motion of a particular joint? We said your head can rotate. It can also move forwards and backwards, your yes and your yes motion, no motion. Okay, so what determines the function of a joint? Good question. What determines the function of a joint? Its structure, right? Okay, so different joints have different structures based on their shape, and we want to talk about what some of these functions are, but before I get into shapes right over here, I want to talk about some motion, and now I can actually breathe a nice sigh of relief, okay, because now I can use these terms, and these are nice anatomic terms that you're maybe not familiar with in everyday language, right? Maybe you've heard of flexion and extension, but you got to know what a good definition of that is. Probably never heard of circumduction or abduction, adduction, supination, dorsiflexion. These are all really important terms, and let's describe what these different motions are. So let's see, do I have any? I got some slides in the book, but it's actually much more interesting to actually somebody, to see somebody perform these motions. Do I see any performance here? Ah, way up over here. Okay. Let's look at flexion and extension first. This is an okay example. Okay. Here is flexion and extension of the vertebral column. All right, so the vertebral column, all the vertebrae have a joint, right? Across the vertebral bodies. So the definition of flexion, I'm going to demonstrate and then apply to this particular figure. So I'm going to turn on a light so that you can kind of see me a little bit. Okay. Is that good enough? Can you see well enough? Okay, let's use an arm and a forearm. What's the joint between an arm and a forearm? That is your elbow, right? And your elbow you can flex and extend. So when I have my arm in this position right here, the bones of my forearm and arm make what? A nice straight line. What is this angle between my forearm and arm? Would you say 90 degrees, 360 degrees? It's 180 degrees, which is what? A straight line, right? If I decrease the angle, can I decrease that angle by? Look what's happening. Now, what is the angle? 90 degrees? Ah, now what's the angle? 45 degrees, something like that. So anyway, when you decrease the angle between two body parts, that's what we call flexion. So when you go like this, that is flexion. When you increase the angle, that's called extension, right? So flexion and extension go together. We call that antagonistic motion, right? Flexion, extension, antagonistic. And you know what? Highlight that term right there, antagonistic. Most important concept in this class is antagonism. That's the most important point in a physiology class, right? So what can you tell me about antagonism? Are you favorable to that concept, or would you kind of avoid antagonism? Do you have a friend that is antagonistic? Do you have a parent, brother, sister that's antagonistic to you? Okay. Usually you don't hang out with antagonistic people. You don't get good feelings, right, because they're always kind of bugging you. But in terms of science and control systems, like controlling your body, it's a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing because, let me tell you what it provides for. It provides for precise control and balance of your body. Okay, so flexion and extension are antagonistic with each other, and that's a good thing, even though they're antagonistic, because it provides for precise control and balance of where your forearm is going, which is where your hand is going, which is where your fingertip is going, right? So when you, what is today, Tuesday? Well, you're probably not going to get pulled over by that person with the blue uniform and badge and sidearm until the weekend, right? When they say, okay, step outside your car and put your fingertip on the tip of your nose, and you can tell the officer, oh, I can do that because I have nice antagonistic motion of my arm and forearm, and I can do that, so I'm not intoxicated. But I maybe wouldn't use that word antagonism with a peace officer, right? Okay, so it's precise control and balance. What antagonistic motion do you have, or mechanisms, sorry, what antagonistic mechanisms do you have in your car that gives you precise control and balance of your automobile that are antagonistic to each other? Your gas pedal, and what opposes your gas pedal is your brake pedal, and that gives you nice control of your car. So antagonism in a control system is super important, right? If you had a gas pedal in your car, doesn't seem too bad, because after work you could hop in your car, drive home, no problem, but when you got home, what would you do? You just have to wave goodbye because you can't stop. Right, so antagonism is super. It's important for the musculoskeletal system. It's so important for your nervous system. It's so important for your endocrine system. And you're going to enjoy that concept in all these different organ systems. Did I say endocrine system? Probably did. Antagonism, very important. When we come back next time, we're going to finish up some of these different motions over here. Or maybe in lab I'll go over them. They're kind of fun to do. And maybe I'll have you guys even make up a dance using all these different kinds of motion. Some are antagonistic, some are not. Okay, so I'll see you up in lab. The sign-in sheet is going around. And be sure to sign that because that is your receipt that you're in class, right? Okay. See you upstairs in about a half hour or so.